In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And thank you for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show, where every week we are helping you get a little more intelligence on big government. You know, we can all disagree on a lot of aspects of government, spending, taxes, and even what the government should or should not be doing. But if there's one thing that nearly all of us can agree on, it's that a government ought to keep its people safe, the common defense. One of the things that it's really hard for everyday good law-abiding people to get their head around is the notion of hatred and violence, and that there really are people over there who are more than willing to kill people just like you in some of the most brutal ways imaginable. There's no greater example of this right now than the Islamic State, ISIS, and while intellectually we can understand that they want to kill Americans or Westerners, it's almost unimaginable when this hits home. It's especially unimaginable to think right now they could be luring your sons or daughters to join them. And yet, this is exactly what happened to our guest today, a mom who lost her son to ISIS. She's now dedicated her life to helping other families avoid this heartache, and we'll talk with her in the second half of our show. But to lay the foundation for our talk with her, and to better understand the Middle Eastern mindset, I'd like to welcome Raymond Ibrahim. Raymond is the author of Crucified Again and the Al-Qaeda Reader. He is currently a fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, as well as a fellow at the Hoover Institution. He writes extensively on current events in the Middle East, Islam, and Christianity, including articles for the New York Times, CNN, LA Times, Fox News, and Jerusalem Post, just to name a few. Raymond, thanks for joining us today. It's an honor to talk to you.
Hello, Mark. I'm very happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You know, aside from your expertise, one of the reasons we really wanted to talk to you today is your unique perspective on the Middle East. You had the benefit of growing up in the U.S. with parents who were Coptic Egyptians, who themselves were born and raised in the Middle East. So you very much can see both mindsets here. And professionally, that has given you the ability to explain one mindset to the other, sort of a belief system translator. So how are the two worldviews different? And what do most Westerners not get about Middle Eastern ways of thinking?
Yeah, sure. This is really an important point, and you know, it has to do with the realm of epistemology, you know, which most people don't really think about, and how our notions and ideas are formed. And they're very much, of course, culturally formed, even though we all like to think that everything we believe and think and say is based on objective knowledge. In fact, all of it gets articulated through a certain cultural paradigm. So the cultural paradigm of the Arab mindset or the Middle Eastern mindset, which, of course, is very much rooted in the Islamic mindset in a way, even though you may not be religious, even though you may not even be Muslim, such as my parents, is really extremely different, I would argue, than the Western mindset. It's, you know, in such a short time, it's hard to get into it, but to just give you some ideas, it's, I think the Western mindset is more open, of course. It's more trusting. Your average, okay, so I just said trusting, but if you talk to a Middle Easterner, they'll tell you, well, the problem with Westerners is they're just so naive. And so, you know, we as in Middle Easterners and so forth take advantage of that. And that definitely is a case. There's more cynicism on that side of the worldview, east of the Atlantic, and south of the Mediterranean, the Middle Eastern mindset. It's more cynical. It's more, I think it has, it's ingrained with the idea of might makes right, sort of. And it goes back, I think, centuries. And this is ironic to mention because when you think about it, the Western mindset will tell you that Middle Easterners and Arabs and Muslims are angry because we're not appeasing enough or there's some kind of grievance that we have to ameliorate and so forth. When in fact, it's oftentimes, and you see this throughout history, for example, during the colonial era, it's in fact when the Western approach is more, let's say, assertive and confident, the Middle Eastern approach becomes more receptive to that and actually tries to emulate it. So, for example, in the colonial era, which when you talk to any academic, Mideast academic, they're going to tell you that this is the root of all the problems. Well, it's really not. If you look at the colonial era, what you're going to see is that is exactly the time that the Muslim world and the Middle East in general turned their back on Islam and became very secularized and westernized, because what they saw is the Western way had triumphed, and so they wanted to be like that. And so what they did is, this is, if you look at pictures from the Middle East of Egypt and Turkey and so forth, in, let's say, the 1920s, you won't see a beard, you won't see the jellabiya that the men wear, you won't see a hijab or a burqa or any of these things that women wear. The women are in skirts, high heels, their hair is down, and so forth. So I think a lot of the Middle Eastern mentality is, it, you know, might makes right. The West was mighty, we're trying to emulate it. And I think now you're seeing a shift where the West is perceived as weak. And of course, this is helped and fed by the apologetic, politically, you know, correct approach from many Western elements. And all of that, I think, is pushing a lot of Middle Easterners back to Islam. And this is, I think, why, or Islamism, this is why you're seeing such a rise in the Islamic movement, beginning especially in the 1970s and so forth with the Iranian Revolution. So definitely there's an antithetical difference, I would argue, between the Middle Eastern mindset and the Western mindset. And I just touched on a couple, really.
Yeah, very antithetical. And what's really interesting about that, too, is you said that the academics are basically seeing the colonial era as the root of all evil. How did they ever arrive at that conclusion?
Well, the problem in academia and in the West and in America is, when it comes to studying the Middle East, they have this thing where they just start in the modern era. And it's as if everything in the medieval era, which is really the heart of what we're talking about, has never existed. And if they do go to the medieval era, it's once again to blame the West for something. So, for example, we all know that the Crusades, the way they're portrayed, are such a horrible thing because out of nowhere, you know, Pope Urban in 1095 declared a crusade, and, you know, all these Franks and so forth and Christians went into Muslim lands, bloodshed, etc. And Muslims since then have never forgiven the West. Now, this is a very popular narrative.
Yes, it
from
is.
Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah, from Hollywood into academia. But the problem is, it's not even half the story. They don't tell you, well, what happened for 500 years before the Crusades? The Crusades, like I said, 1095, it starts. Well, in 632, that's when the Islamic armies started invading Christendom.
Yeah.
And most people don't understand that in the 7th century, what made up the Christian world or Christendom, two-thirds of that was actually conquered by Islam and taken over right before the Crusades. So really the Crusades, as every true historian would know, was a response to a constant jihad and constant conquest of Christian lands. If you read the words of Pope Urban when he calls for the crusade, it's amazing. We're talking about ISIS. The things that he's talking to the Christians, and he tells them the things that they're doing in Jerusalem and to Christians include things like burning their churches, raping their women, enslaving their women. And as you know, this is all what ISIS is doing right now.
Yeah.
So it's such an old story, but there's this penchant in the West to always kind of overlook the Islamic aggression and just pinpoint whenever the West defends itself and then portray that defense as some kind of aggression and hostility, and that's why Muslims are angry. So definitely when it comes to academia, the whole story has been very much skewed.
Yeah, it has, unfortunately. All right, let's take a break right there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more on the Middle Eastern mindset with Raymond Ibrahim. Stay with us. Today on I Spy Radio, it's all about ISIS. Right now, we're talking with Raymond Ibrahim, a Middle East and Islam specialist. He is the author of Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, and the Al-Qaeda Reader. And, of course, we'll make sure that we link those up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for today's show. That's show number 518. And then later on, we'll be talking with a mother who lost her son to ISIS. And I want to talk a little bit about this idea of ISIS recruiting youth here in North America. Is there a particular appeal to the Middle Eastern mindset to recruit the youth of your enemy as opposed to simply recruiting from within your own ranks?
Well, that's ironic, actually. From the dawn of Islam, this was actually an institution. Let's just look at the Ottoman Empire, for example, in modern-day Turkey, back when it was the Ottoman Empire, which was really the last caliphate before this so-called caliphate, Islamic State. One of their practices was to invade Christian territory in Europe, and let's say, for example, Greece, and they would actually take as tribute young, healthy, strong boys and take them and indoctrinate them in Islam. So they would grow up not just Islamic, they would be fanatics, they would be ISIS. This is all they know, and they would grow and they would raise them as warriors, too. They were called Janissaries. And then they would unleash them back on their territories to do jihad and to kill and to plunder and to take more captives. So this idea is definitely nothing new. I mean, we're looking at it in a different, you know, more modern setting, modern format. But the idea of, you know, recruiting your enemy's children, indoctrinating them, and then setting them loose, that goes way back. And there was also the Mamluks in Egypt, which was the same thing. They were mostly Circassian slaves brought in, and then they were Christian, indoctrinated, and grew up to become warriors, really. And they took over, actually, a big chunk. But they were just basically slaves who were Christians, and they became the most fanatical Muslims. So you're seeing this again, and you know, outside of the West, you see this happen all the time, where they'll take Christian minorities and they'll throw them in mosques where they're literally boys, and they just indoctrinate them in jihad. And of course, when you're just a young child, you grow up in that context, you're going to fall for it. It's going to be all you know.
Sure. Well, speaking of falling for it, we're seeing more and more these cases of parents losing their kids to ISIS. Once they get over there, is there any chance of these kids ever being able to escape that? I mean, is there any such thing as allowing kids to change their mind and go home?
No. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's a propaganda element, of course, where it might, you know, in the advertisement, they'll say kind of like money back guarantee. If you don't like it, you can leave. But of course, once you're there, I think that really changes. And you've seen echoes of this from a lot of people, including the women. You're probably familiar with the whole context of the sex jihad, where women actually travel to the Islamic State just to copulate with men. And that's considered jihad because the men are fighting on behalf of Islam, and well, they have no women, so the women are sacrificing their bodies to these men so the men can continue fighting and not become demoralized and leave the battlefield and so forth. So, you know, there's a lot of rationale that's being used and fatwas or Islamic decrees and so forth, but, you know, when they get there, a lot of the people who have escaped and gotten back, I remember reading about one girl who came back thinking that she was going to go do this sort of, you know, copulation jihad, and thinking that she's somehow going to be married to one of them. She came back and reported how she was basically raped, gang raped by maybe 24 different men. And she said all these different nationalities and so forth. And she's finally managed to return with AIDS and pregnant. So obviously it's not necessarily, you know, the martyrdom in heaven that's being, you know, in the propaganda portion.
Well, I'm surprised, actually, she got away.
Well, maybe they got rid of her. Who even knows? Because she was pregnant and with AIDS.
You know, let's talk. You've got a number of great articles up on your website, and we're going to link up a bunch of those. But one of your recent articles is that the Pentagon admits to no real strategy to blunt ISIS expansion. I mean, that headline alone is pretty shocking. But within that, Colonel Stephen Warren, he's the director for the Pentagon's press office, claimed that the spread of ISIS into other countries was essentially a rebranding effort by existing terrorist organizations. What do you make of that?
You know, what I make of it is, you know, again, when I try to talk about something in the now, it's best to kind of go back and get a, you know, stand back and look at the big picture. And the big picture that always, when someone says what you just said and I think about it, all I can say is, the United States went into Iraq about one decade ago to fight Saddam Hussein. Now, Saddam Hussein was an entrenched military and one of the strongest militaries in the Middle East. And this is a person who was there for decades. And we took him out in 3 weeks, I believe it was. So I'm trying to understand and kind of get my mind around the fact that now you have what was described as a ragtag team of terrorists and pickup trucks who've just popped out of nowhere. And they're nowhere near as entrenched or well-organized or even had the sort of, or should not have the sort of military power that Saddam Hussein did. But somehow we can't take them out. And I don't understand that. Why aren't these guys already defeated quickly?
Yeah.
And that's really the question. I mean, again, remember, we took out Saddam. This was, I mean, the nation's entire military was taken out. And now these guys, we can't neutralize them, and we keep... And then the reports, like you're saying, you know, from the Pentagon, once it's kind of like, oh, we've made headway and so forth, then 2 weeks later, you get another report of how, oh, ISIS actually just got more land, and it's bigger than ever.
Well, I'm sure they have advisors around them. Is this just simply bad advice? Do they not want to believe them? I mean, how do they not understand that that they're being perceived as weak right now?
Well, I mean, see, that's just it. When a question like this comes up, I have two responses. Either the entity we're talking about is not trying or doesn't want to win, or it can't. Now, I find it very difficult to think that the U.S. military can't defeat ISIS. They can. So the question is, why aren't they? And, you know, is it the Obama administration leadership not allowing them to fully go in and actually, you know, exterminate ISIS the way they should be? I mean, remember, this ISIS group is the most atrocious human rights, you know, abusing. This is basically what you're seeing is the new genocide of the 21st century, what's happening in that region. The United Nations had a recent Security Council meeting about Christians and other minorities under ISIS, and they use the word genocide regularly, including, you know, different nations and their leaders about what's happening. So I don't understand what the, you know, what the reason is to sit and wait and not take these guys out in the most, you know, brutal fashion. These are people who set other humans on fire.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
and torture them and behead them. So.
Yeah, and if the only thing they understand is strength, boy, you better be showing it rather than weakness. And unfortunately, that's exactly it.
Going back to the Arab mindset, everything we're doing actually reinforces what they think and makes them want to join ISIS because they say, okay, here's the strong course, you know, and it's not the United States or the West.
Yeah, unbelievable. You know, unfortunately, we are up against the clock here, so we need to part ways, but we definitely need to have you back on.
Sure, great. Look forward to it.
All right, everyone stay with us. Coming up, Chris Boudreau, that mom who lost her son to ISIS. You will not want to miss this. And thanks for staying with us on the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, and today it's really all about ISIS. And we just got off the phone with Raymond Ibrahim. He is a Middle East specialist. And, of course, make sure that you check today's show page for some links to some of his books and articles. Really fascinating stuff. We're definitely going to have him back on. I'd like to welcome now a mom who lost her son to ISIS. And this is a terrible tragedy, as you can imagine. And she is really dealing with this now by helping others try to avoid this. And Chris Boudreau, I'd like to welcome you to our show. And I really have to say how terribly sorry I am that you're joining us under such circumstances.
Thank you.
You know, that has to be so difficult. I really don't think even a lot of people, certainly myself included, can even really begin to understand that. I know that as a parent, that's always one of your worst fears is that you lose your child. And but even to lose it under... even to lose your son under such horrific circumstances. I mean, I don't even know where to start, really, other than the fact that I'd like to maybe start trying to understand him a little bit more as a person. So talk to us a little bit about him. Describe his childhood for us. I mean, was he raised in a church environment? And what were some of the influences he had growing up?
Well, we started off in a very small community in Nova Scotia. And at that time, we didn't move until Calgary until he was six. But he was outgoing, he was social, he had a lot of interests regards to sports, just absolutely loved sports, cooking with me, very close family environment. We would travel, take camping trips, typical middle-class family growing up. And then we moved to Calgary when he was 6 years old for work purposes out in Alberta. And he integrated well with his school, was doing really well when we got set up, made friends easily again, kept in contact with his old friends, again, was very active in sports and athletics at school. He was extremely intelligent, so we had a few struggles along the way that way. A few times I had teachers call me in to talk to them about it, and, you know, they'd tell me, please stop teaching him at home. And I had to tell them I wasn't. He started learning to read on his own at a very early age and so on and so forth. So he got bored easily in class, would be done everything by, you know, 10 minutes throughout the class and then horse around the rest of the time, so it distracted everybody else. But as far as church goes, we were pretty lax about it. We'd go, you know, typical Christmas Eve, Easter, and then as he grew older, probably around 10 or 11, I started to go much more regularly in a United Church here in Calgary.
So did he have, his name is Damien, I should say, Damien Claremont, and he later changed his name to Mustafa Al-Gharib. But did he have other siblings, sisters, brothers, anything?
He did, actually. He lost a brother when he was about 10 and a half. I had twins, a set of twins. A boy, girl, and my son passed away, SIDS. So we went through that trauma. And he had a sister as a result, the surviving twin, another little brother, and that's how he was raised.
Well, so you talked about his early success in school. He was obviously a very bright child and was outgoing. So at what point did things start to kind of turn sideways?
When he was about 14, 15 years old, things started to change. He started struggling at school, skipping classes. He was bored, and he was still scoring 80s and 90s without turning in homework, without showing up for class. Continued the athletics, but he was getting very restless, and he started changing personas, trying to find a peer group that he fit in with. You could tell he was quite agitated and fed up. Eventually, that led to him dropping out of school and picking it up again through a distance online learning program. He started off really strong with that, and the teachers were saying they'd never had such work turned in before. They were amazed. But it took a lot of self-motivation, and that kept up for about 3-4 months, and soon he dropped that as well. And started becoming quite depressed.
And did you ever determine a cause for why that change?
No, we never did. I took him to counseling. I took him to one counselor here in Calgary, and after 2 months, they said basically he was too smart for them. He kept dancing circles around them, and he couldn't help them, so take him somewhere else. I had him on wait lists for Big Brother, Big Sister programs, 2-year wait lists. They were incredible.
So he was the oldest then?
He definitely was by quite a bit.
Okay.
Again, he was 10 and a half when the twins were born, so the distance, the age distance was there.
So in one of the news articles that I read about him, at 17 he attempted suicide. What led up to that? And again, were there any signs or symptoms that had you concerned up until that? I mean, that he would go that far to try to take his own life?
Actually, no. I was, at that point, starting to feel better about everything. He'd become kind of agoraphobic, I guess you could say. Wouldn't leave the house. If we did go somewhere in the car, he'd pull a hoodie over his face. Didn't want to be outside in public. Just interacted with my friends that came in. And mostly chatted online. And I started taking him into work with me, where he started learning technology. I was working for an IT corporation at the time, and he was understudying for free, just learning more about virtual machines and such and networks. And he started seeming like he was cheering up. He was getting out of the house. I started to relax a bit, seeing that he was coming out of it. But a day after his 17th birthday is when he attempted to take his life.
So, and then at some point, he had become attracted to the Muslim religion. Talk to us a little bit about that. How did he end up going that direction? Did he meet somebody? I mean, what were the circumstances that led him to conversion?
Well, I learned while he was in the hospital, he had a 2-month stay after he recovered from the episode. And at that time, I learned from a psychiatrist he'd been communicating with a young Muslim girl online, and she dumped him because he wouldn't come out of the house to meet with her in person, and she'd gotten frustrated. But they'd been communicating for quite some time. So after he got out of the hospital, he had said to me before, he'd stopped coming to church with me at certain points, saying that the Bible is quite contradictory. He couldn't find any meaning within it. And at that time, he started just going down to the mosque, trying to learn a little bit more about the Muslim faith, and made the decision shortly thereafter to convert.
I see. All right, let's take our break right there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Chris Boudreau. She lost her son to ISIS. This is a fascinating and sad story that she is sharing with us. And coming up, we'll be talking especially about what parents can be doing to hopefully identify these kinds of issues going on with their own teens. Stay with us. And thanks for staying with us on the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today with Chris Boudreau, a mom who lost her son to ISIS when he left the family to join the Syrian rebels. He was later killed in fighting. And Chris, I'd like to pick up the story where we left off. Damien was there in the hospital, and you had found out from a psychologist that he, meaning Damien, had been in contact with a Muslim girl. So what was your reaction to hearing that?
I was quite surprised, mostly because I hadn't seen him talking to her. He had never discussed this relationship you'd had over the internet. It was never anything that was on my radar. Hmm. So I hadn't even been aware that there was anything going on.
You know, that's often, you know, knowing our own kids, and you know, that's sometimes the identifier when there's troubles is when they're not, it's not so much what they say, but it's a lot of time what they're not saying. So why do you suspect it is that he didn't discuss his relationship with you?
Damien was always a very private person when it came to his emotions. So it was very difficult and challenging to talk to him about anything he felt close about. Hmm. After my first son's passing, it was very excruciating to try to get any reaction out of him or to get him to talk about it and open up to try to see how I could help him heal. So that's the type of person he was. It was a challenge at best. On an intellectual level, not a problem having conversations. But on an emotional level, it was a huge struggle.
Interesting. And then, so did the psychologist, or in your discussions with him later, was the suicide attempt directly related to the fact that she was breaking up with him?
He had indicated to me at that time that he thought it was the last straw, the straw that broke the camel's back.
I see.
Damien had struggled for some time, yeah.
So it was just one more thing in addition to everything else that he was struggling with internally, so...
That's right.
So in terms of converting to the Muslim faith, how did that all play out? I mean, was it directly through this Muslim girl that he met? You know, talk to us about that. How did he end up moving from a Christian family into, you know, obviously a radicalized form of Islam?
Well, originally when he first converted, it was 2008, so it was early onset. He wasn't radical at all. So the conversion process, I think it was just a base of curiosity after all his discussions with this other girl. And he just decided, as being a curious person that he always was, an interest in learning as much as he could about everything. He just followed through and started seeking out knowledge about the Muslim faith.
And where did he see that going? I mean, I think I read in one of the articles that he was interested in becoming an imam. Is that correct?
Correct. Over time, as he grew closer in his faith, it actually was good for him in the beginning. He became much more grounded, peaceful, started getting out again, working again, living his life. And the private side started disappearing. We started meeting new friends, great people, and I could see it was a positive effect. And over time, he said, you know, I have a real strong connection. I found my faith. I know where I fit. Hmm. And he started talking about becoming an imam early onset.
And was he attending a local mosque? I mean, who were some of the friends that he was meeting? And were they also tied to the Muslim faith?
We have quite a few mosques here in our city, different sects and different areas. And, yes, the friends he was bringing home were the ones that he met at the mosque. Really kind, peaceful young men. And I was really proud of him, that he seemed to be finding his own skin and settling in.
Hmm. So he did eventually leave the country. So what did he tell you? First of all, how did he approach you about leaving? Where did he say he was going, and what was he going to do?
Well, he didn't start approaching us about leaving until summer of 2012. And he started talking about going to university in Egypt. And he would like to study Arabic and linguistics because it would be an important factor of becoming an imam, is understanding the language. And he had gone to take some upgrading and complete his grade 12 and was preparing. So it looked to us as if he was preparing to go to university.
Hmm. And was there anything at all concerning about this? I mean, you know, a lot of times you have family members saying, well, they're going to go off and be philosophers or, you know, join the clergy and so on and so forth. Was any of this alarming at all?
Quite honestly, no, I didn't think he was going to go anywhere. When he was 16 years old, he had an opportunity to study cooking in France with a fantastic chef and live with my parents for the summer. And he didn't want to leave because he didn't want to be far away from his younger brother. They had a very close relationship. So I thought it was mostly talk again and that he wasn't even going to leave. I didn't come to the conclusion that it was real until he called me from the airplane.
Wow. So he just suddenly up and left all of a sudden. It wasn't like, well, you know, I'm going to be leaving in a month and was obviously making all these plans. He just suddenly up and gone. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was really quick to when he said, I'm actually leaving. I've got a spot. I've made all the arrangements. I've saved up the money. I'm leaving in a couple of weeks. He was visiting with us the day before he left, and the next day he was on a plane.
Wow. So what in the world is going through your head at that point?
Well, when he phoned, I just like a mother does, instincts, spidey senses were tingling.
Sure.
It didn't feel right. And I cried. I just started to bawl. It was 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh,
and
Lord.
The whole day at work, I just cried all day.
Wow. So, of course, you find out later on through the Canadian intelligence services that what he had told you that he was leaving for Egypt wasn't exactly true. What did they tell you?
Well, they didn't turn up on our doorstep until January 23rd, 2013. And at that point, it was exactly a month to the day since I'd last spoken with Damien, and I was growing concerned. I'd heard of some unrest in Egypt, and I was scared that he'd gotten caught up in that.
let's back up a little bit so we have the timeline correct. So he got on the day that he called you and he was on the plane. What year was that?
That was November 12, 2012.
2012. And so then the intelligence services show up on your door about a year later. Is that correct?
No, not even that.
Just over two months. Just a few months. Okay. And so did he ever actually land in Egypt? Where did he end up going?
No, he actually landed in Istanbul. He had flown from Calgary to Seattle, Seattle to Amsterdam, and they were able to track his flight to Turkey.
So then at that point, he ends up joining in with an extremist group, and it sounds like you were, actually I'm getting the sign from my producer here, we're up against the time, so we will pick this story up on the other side of this break. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson. We are talking with Chris Boudreau. She is a mom who lost her son to ISIS when he left the family to join the Syrian rebels, and he was later killed in that fighting. And so, Chris, really fascinating story so far. You find out from the Canadian intelligence services there that what you had been told, what he had told you, Damien had told you, that he was going to head to Egypt and study to be an imam, turned out not to be true. Had instead boarded the plane to Istanbul and ended up crossing the border into Syria. I can't imagine what you were thinking when you heard this.
I was blown away. I was in shock. They were here for about 2 hours. So throughout the discussion, they began asking questions if we'd recognize certain people. And at that point in his life, the old friends that we had seen before, we stopped seeing them and we didn't get introduced to any of the new ones. So we didn't recognize anybody, and it was difficult to believe. I thought they were mistaken. There was no way that my son would do something like that. And I was sick to my stomach.
So how on earth did he manage to make contact with these people?
Well, apparently, it turns out he was recruited by somebody here in the city who met him in person after prayer one day. He was living in a different part of the city at this point and had been attending a couple of new mosques and was part of a youth group that they were watching the whole group. And it turned out that all the men, the young men part of that group, all left.
And did any of those young men, were they part of the friends that he was bringing over that were there in your home?
No, we'd never met these young men. So his life changed in 2011 again, and he became private again. And even when he had phone calls, when he was visiting, he would go outside to take them.
You know, one of the things that I've seen in a couple of the articles was that your family was really disappointed with how the Canadian government has been handling this. And also I think it was his grandfather was especially upset by the Canadian government's lack of intervention. Apparently they had been watching this, but then did nothing to stop him. Is that correct? And what are your thoughts?
That's absolutely correct. What they had indicated to us when they were here that day is that they've been watching him and the other group of young men for almost 2 years. And not once did they try to intervene or notify us. In fact, Passport Services, which is part of the Canadian government as well, issued him a passport 2 months before he left.
And none of this was caught by the government. I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, you hear about here in the U.S. that the FBI catches these people at the airport. They just let them go.
They just let them go. They didn't even attempt to notify us or raise any concerns with us. And at that time, in 2012, we'd never heard of this phenomenon. We didn't even know it existed. And apparently it was something they were trying to keep quiet.
Wow. Ugh. That just gives me the chills to hear that you've got to feel betrayed, I imagine.
In a big way, I tried to get answers. I wrote letters. All I got was the runaround, people passing me off. Finally, to the point where they denied a lot of different things, and I couldn't believe they were even trying to insinuate that I would lie about something like this.
Wow. Oh, man. So when he's over there in Syria, how did you stay in contact with him, or was there any contact with him at that point?
Well, finally, towards the end of February 2013, I received a text message from him, and I looked at the country code on my phone, and sure enough, it said Syria. And so when I called him, when I got home that evening, I confronted him. I didn't tell him that the Security Intelligence Service had been here. I just told him that I looked up the country code on the phone, and it indicated he was in Syria. And at that time, he admitted that, yes, he was there, and that he'd made the decision to go to help protect women and children. And he didn't want to tell me because he didn't want me to worry, and he didn't want me to go through the depression I'd gone through when I lost my first son.
Oh, man. So how did you then receive word of his death?
So that wasn't until January 14, 2014. At that time, I hadn't heard from Damien at all since the beginning of September of 2013. And I was at home working. It was 9:45 in the evening. My telephone rang, and it was a journalist from the Globe and Mail here in Canada calling to ask me about a recent photo of Damien because he'd received a Twitter tweet with a eulogy alongside of a picture of Damien, and it was using his Christian name, indicating his death.
Hmm. Wow. I just am totally blown away by that. I just cannot imagine what you had to deal with and what you were thinking.
Well, the first moment was a week prior, I'd started looking at videos again, trying to find him. Again, spidey senses were tingling, and I grew concerned, and then I noticed all the infighting, and that's when my stomach sank, and I think I was kind of prepared. At the same time, it's almost as if I already knew, and I just froze and contacted another journalist friend of mine whom I knew had contacts over there and asked her to find out the truth, because we just never know how much of it's true or not what's being posted by these guys that are over there.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely shocking and stunning. Let's go ahead and take our break right here. When we come back, we definitely want to talk with you, get your thoughts on what other parents should be looking for in all of this. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Chris Boudreau. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now on the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about ISIS and really the terrible tragedy of Chris Boudreau, who lost her son to ISIS when he left the family to join the Syrian rebels. And Chris, you have a GoFundMe page that's out there. You're trying to raise funds to help raise awareness on this and raise some education for this sort of thing. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that? What's the link for that?
It's on my HyattCanadaWebs.com website.
Okay.
It's for Hyatt Canada Family Support, which is an organization. We help support families that are going through this. We do risk assessments if they have concerns, and we also help coach those families through specific dialogue they can have with their youth if they feel they're headed down that path to try to help reverse the radicalization process.
And Hyatt, just so that people know, is H-A-Y-A-T, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, and we'll definitely make sure that we link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Again, just look for today's show. That's 518. So we just got done talking with you about learning about your son's death, and again, just I cannot imagine going through that. But what kinds of supports did you have around you at that point? Who did you reach out to?
Well, the only people I could reach out to really were friends and family. So for the longest period of time, CSIS, who is our security intelligence agency, had asked us not to speak to anybody outside of the home. And we've never heard of it again. So eventually, over time, I lost my patience with them, needless to say.
Yeah.
Started reaching out. It connected with some journalists because that's the only help I could get. And they found a couple of organizations for me. And through that, I've been speaking with. Yeah, and I've been speaking with them to try to help everything that we could. And specifically, counselors were just completely frustrated if I called them because they'd never heard of it either. So trying to get help for my younger children was excruciating.
Oh, yeah.
Because they thought I was crazy making it up.
Wow. Wow. So we want to make sure that we spend some time talking with you about what other parents could be doing. So looking back over what Damien went through, do you see any signs in retrospect or any symptoms that others ought to be looking for with their own children?
Absolutely. In 2011, when things started to change for him again, what happened was he became much more rigid in his stance with the Islamic faith. He wouldn't join us at the table if we had a bottle of wine. He started talking about taking more than one wife. He was just completely focused on old, rigid stance of the Islamic faith, as well as he was getting more agitated, disconnected, much more private, would put his youth group that he kept talking about first, started working out, disconnecting as far as any friendships and stuff that he'd had in the past. We didn't see them anymore. He had new friends. We never met these ones. And he started actually arguing about democracy, about the Western world, and how we were selfish, and how there were wars going on where women and children were being tortured, and we as a country did nothing, and that we were too focused on alcohol and drugs and sex, and that what our kids watched on TV was not appropriate. And he also even started bringing up 9/11 conspiracy theories.
Yeah. In terms of other parents that may be dealing with this or end up dealing with this, once these kids leave the countries, do you know if there's any kind of resorts that parents have? I mean, it doesn't sound like the government has been much help. I mean, who do they even begin to reach out to? We have about a minute here with you.
Well, I've been working with families, so if they reach out, there's a web form contact. They can reach out to us as anonymous as they like, make up an email address. They don't have to give us a name. And they can contact us for Hyatt Canada Family Support. And we can work through everything with them to try to communicate with the youth at hand through the social network to try to bring them back in or at least make sure they don't lose contact. We have contacts in Iraq, Syria, and in Turkey that we can reach out to if these youngsters do want to come back. The biggest problem we have is with policies and issues, laws in various countries and to what the legislation is going to announce, whether they'll be arrested when they come back in or whether we have to try to help them find some way to stay in Turkey and stay safe.
Chris, pretty amazing story. And I got to really commend you for doing what you're doing. It is so admirable that you're dealing with this situation by trying to help others. Thank you for everything that you're doing, and God bless you in all of your efforts.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. It's time for us to get going, but be sure to check out our new and improved website, which has been completely overhauled to make it easier to find and share information. To get a little more intelligence on the Middle Eastern mindset, we've got links to Raymond Ibrahim's site, his articles, and his books. He has a huge knowledge base on all this, and we'll definitely have to have him back. Before we leave you, I'd like to say it again that Chris's group does have people over there who can get someone out. They can meet them there at the border to get kids out and back to safety. They do have a funding page if you'd like to help out with that. It takes resources to do all this, and $10, $20, or $100 is not too much to ask, especially if it can help stop a kid from getting swept up in all this. If nothing else, share the links to today's show. It's absolutely free to help spread the word. Contact info for Chris's organization is up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for this week's show page, or if you're listening to this through a third-party link or an archive version somewhere else, look on our archives page for show 518. That's 5-18, and there will be a permanent link to a web page for today's show. Like, share, and spread the word, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.